Artie, thank you for accommodating us. Please go ahead.
Of course. Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. On behalf of Amicus New Jersey Business and Industry Association, I'd like to thank the court for the opportunity to address the important issues under consideration today. The Wage Theft Act, and particularly as interpreted by the Appellate Division, made drastic changes to the law in New Jersey. It tripled the statute of repose. It disturbed vested rights thereunder. It tripled the monetary exposure without advance notice for already completed conduct that we submit was already wiped clean by the statute of repose. It added fee shifting to the wage payment law for the first time. It created a new retaliation claim under the wage payment law with presumptions of adverse action and the possibility of jail time. It expanded the retaliation claims available under the wage and hour law and also allows for jail time for such violations. It provides for stop work orders. With these drastic changes, the legislature would have been very clear if retroactivity was intended. Instead, the legislature used shall take effect immediately, which pursuant to this court's numerous cases has long been interpreted as signifying only prospective application. Business groups such as NJBIA certainly would have been objecting if the statute said that it was going to apply retroactively to completed conduct, and it doesn't say that anywhere. And I summarize those changes in the statute, even though there aren't claims, for example, for retaliation in this particular case, but from the perspective of NJBIA, which represents a large cross-section of employers, large and small, those employers could certainly face retaliation claims, and we would appreciate the court's guidance on whether there could be liability for conduct predating the statute that now might be deemed retaliatory, especially with the presumptions created under that statute.
Hey, can you shed any light on the question that was being discussed just before the lunch break? And that is other examples where the legislature has expanded the statute of a statute of limitations. And I want to leave aside the issue as to whether this is a statute of repose, but a statute or statute of limitations. Is there any example that you are aware of where the conduct, where there's an amendment on a particular date with the effect of immediately language, and it looped in conduct that that preceded that effective date?
I apologize, Your Honor. I cannot identify one for you as I sit here. I'd be happy to go back, put on my thinking cap, and try to see if I could find something directly responsive to your question.
You talked about how this amendment interfered with vested rights. Looking only at the allegations in this complaint, what vested right? You're not referring, of course, to a vested right not to pay wages under the WHL, right?
No, Your Honor. We're not talking about the right to not pay wages. We're talking about the right, especially in the case of the prospective class here, which looks to sue going back 6 years, which would be into 2016. We're talking about the vested right to have a clean slate, the expectation of employers that their slate was wiped clean by the statute of repose. And
That's not relevant in the actual allegations here, which the appellate division said that it was limiting its decision to, correct? Meaning nothing was wiped clean because no one worked for the employer before 2 years before August 6, 2019.
That's my understanding of the facts, Your Honor, correct. There were some questions raised before that I would like to take an opportunity to respond to, if I may. There was a question raised about whether the statute is one of limitations or of repose. And we submit that, first of all, the appellate division recognized it as a statute of repose, and the plaintiffs have acknowledged in their brief in opposition for leave to appeal on pages 1 and 15 that, in fact, it's a statute of repose. The language here is more like a statute of repose, certainly, than a statute of limitations. It does not speak of accrual. It uses the word claim has arisen, which connotes the happening of an event, a mistake in paying someone properly, which is a completed event, which is very much like completed work for an architect under the statute of repose.
But can also be accrual, can it? I mean, isn't there language that where a claim arises on X date is another way of saying that the claim accrued?
I believe in statute of limitations context of, for example, a personal injury action, accrual would connote knowledge that the plaintiff knew or should have known of the nature and cause of an injury. We don't have any language like that here. In fact, the contract claim and a personal injury claim both speak of commencing action within X number of years after the cause of any such action shall accrued.
But if you, and I don't have it, I apologize, I don't have it in front of me, but the construction statute of repose.
I have it. May I read it?
Please.
Because if the question is, what sounds more like what? This is the language in 2A14-1.1 section A. No action, .. shall be brought against any person, .. more than 10 years after the performance of construction services. That's not what 25.1 says. 25.1 speaks about when a claim has arisen. That's why the question.
I understand the court's concern.
Which does 25.1 sound more like? The statute of repose or the traditional statutes of limitation that deals with accrual?
I submit it sounds more like a statute of repose because it speaks of no claim shall be valid, which is much more akin to.
But focus on the operative words, which has arisen more than 6 years before.
I believe the has arisen speaks of a completed course of conduct that, for example, a failure to pay minimum wage or overtime. The statute of repose in the Parentage Act, which this court discussed in RAC, is not identical to the architect statute, but yet that's deemed a statute of repose. That provides in NJSA 9:17-45B, no action shall be brought under the act more than 5 years after the child attains the age of majority.
But the interesting thing about, I think the other statutes of repose that we're talking about here is there is a definitive date and an event, completion of construction date, the child turns 18, a definitive date that doesn't relate to the claim. It's not when the claim arises. It's not when the claim is known to the person. It isn't when the claim accrues. It's a date that nobody can really dispute. And that's just one of the features of a statute of the ones that we're talking about here. There are not many of them, but it seems to me this is sort of unique language.
I agree it's unique language. I haven't been able to find another limitations statute exactly like this, but I still...
And, you know, to your point, it also doesn't sound like the statute of limitations language that's in the statutes, the more traditional, the six-year, the two-year, et cetera, that we're familiar with.
I agree, Your Honor. I think that might have persuaded the Appellate Division to conclude, as it did, that this functions as a statute of repose.
Does it matter for this case?
It matters, Your Honor, if the court is not persuaded that just by relying on ordinary principles of statutory construction, this court's three-factor test for retroactivity, if the court isn't persuaded that this statute should not be applied retroactively to conduct predating its effective date. But it decides to go further and consider that it is retroactive. We then face constitutional issues that I think the court would probably prefer to avoid by using statutory construction. But if it is a statute of repose, we submit that it created vested rights that, again, it would be applicable to the proposed class here, but it would also be applicable to businesses around New Jersey that could face class actions from employees who would try to go back 6 years from the filing of a complaint today. There could be other cases out there like this where parties are trying to stretch back 6 years into conduct that under a statute of repose had been wiped clean. The slate was clean. And we submit that those would be serious constitutional issues to essentially create new causes of action where those claims have been extinguished or found not valid under the language.
So do you agree there's a constitutional difference between a statute of limitations that already, or sorry, a statute of repose, if we're assuming that this is that had already expired, say for conduct that occurred in 2014, which is 6 years before 2019, but it had the statute of limitations expired in 2016, and have that then be, you know, sprung into possibility again in 2019 versus for conduct that happened only a few months before. And so the statute of repose was still running at the time that the amendment went into effect.
I think there is both would raise constitutional problems, I submit. The scenario where claims were clearly no longer valid under the statute of repose and would be resurrected. I think that implicates a vested rights constitutional problem. For claims for conduct predating the effective date, I think it implicates due process concerns in terms of notice and changing someone's potential liability for conduct that's already completed.
Do you have any case to rely on that has said that there is a due process concern in that circumstance when a statute of limitations is changed and how it can apply to a statute of limitations that hadn't yet run or even a statute of repose?
Well, we cited some out-of-state cases in our brief where some courts from around the country, state courts, have applied statute of repose as creating vested rights that would not be undone. It would be unconstitutional to resurrect those. I think they might have used the term moribund. Might be the first time I've said that word aloud. Moribund claims, bringing them back to life.
Understood. I'm asking about claims that have not already died and been resurrected. A claim that's still pending. The statute of repose has not run at the time that it's changed.
Your Honor, I'm struggling to think of a good example. I know that the U.S. Supreme Court had concerns about retroactively applying the Civil Rights Act of 1991 to conduct that predated that statute and to avoid the constitutional issues the court relied on statutory construction, the presumption of prospective application, but they did at least allude to potential constitutional problems of some magnitude arising from punishing conduct that was already completed.
You mentioned the amendment created the potential for, I guess, in the most extreme circumstances, a jail sentence.
Yes, Your Honor.
And was there anything like that pre-amendment?
There was a disorderly person's offense, but it didn't, as I recall, involve jail time. It involved a fine or penalty. But the added prospect of going to jail is a even if it's considered a disorderly person's offense, it certainly has consequences of magnitude.
In the criminal world.
In the criminal world. And I think reading the enactment as a whole, which this court in Hildreth specifically said should be done, when amendments are passed jointly or as part of a legislative scheme, you must construe them together to make sense of the legislative intent. I think based on that language, the court has to take into account the possibility of jail time, stop work orders, presumptions of adverse action for retaliation.
What is the most, the jail time is obviously a criminal penalty. What is the most severe civil penalty that the amended statute presents as a possibility that is not in the pre-amendment version?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last part.
Didn't exist prior to the amendment.
Well, certainly the treble damages was nowhere to be found prior to the amendment. Let me open up to the statute.
The liquidated damages?
Correct. The actual loss plus double that, which I've shorthanded as treble damages. I'm just trying to scroll quickly to the financial consequences. A first violation, and I'm looking to NJSA 3411-56A24. Shall be guilty of a disorderly person's offense and shall, upon conviction, be fined not less than $500 nor more than $1,000, or by imprisonment for not less than 10 nor more than 90 days, or by both the fine and imprisonment, and upon conviction for a second or subsequent violation, be punished by a fine if not less than $1,000 nor more than $2,000, or by imprisonment for not less than 10 nor more than 100 days, or by both the fine and imprisonment.
Counsel, to your knowledge, has the employer been brought up on charges as to any of the plaintiffs in this case?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. But I think reading the statute as a whole, including these imprisonment consequences, I think militates in favor of only a prospective application, especially when someone is facing jail time, even if a disorderly person's offense may not be technically considered a crime for ex post facto purposes, it still raises, at very least, due process concerns.
And it may explain the language take effect immediately, which you view to be prospective.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's the most fair interpretation, especially for people looking to avoid going to jail, that they'd at least have a fair warning that that's what they would be facing, not just a financial penalty.
So, counsel, just to be clear on your understanding is that as of August 7th, 2019, there was a clean slate and no possible penalty for the employers at that point?
I'm submitting that for conduct happening after the effective date of the statute. The amendments would apply beginning to conduct on August 7th, 2019. For conduct that happened prior to that amendment, if it goes back far enough, it would be extinguished by the statute of repose. Even if it's not extinguished by the statute of repose, it still would be visiting new consequences on completed conduct to retroactively apply the amendment to conduct that had not yet been barred by the two-year statute, but certainly would be beyond the expectations of employers, especially when viewed with the shall take effect immediately language and this court's jurisprudence on that, with which the legislature is presumed to be aware of when it passed the law.
Is there anything else you'd like to add to your presentation?
I'd just like to repeat that the court can avoid the sticky constitutional issues through traditional statutory construction principles.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Blanchfield?
Good afternoon, Chief Justice and Justices of the Court. May it please the Court. Something that is really prevalent in this matter is that no party nor any amicus has disputed the fact that the public policy in New Jersey is to protect employees, protect their health, protect their efficiency and general well-being. That has been the law in New Jersey since the 1960s. It's embedded in the New Jersey wage and hour law, and it has time and time again been approved by this court. It's humanitarian legislation. It's remedial. It should be liberally construed. And no party here disputes that. And when looking at the Wage Theft Act amendments that occurred on August 6, 2019, and applying that to the facts of this case, it's clear that plaintiffs Maya and Howarth are entitled to all the remedies provided by the Wage Theft Act. That includes a six-year look-back period and all the remedies that are there. When the court is looking at specifically amendments to a statute and how the scope and the application of here the Wage Theft Act, they first have to look at the plain language of the statute to see the legislative intent. And here it's clear. You know, there's one thing that I actually agree with the defendant. I'm not asking for retroactive application. I've said it time and time again. I don't want retroactive application. I've never made that argument. I want prospective application of the statute. The Wage Theft Act said it's effective immediately. And based on the plain language, that's unambiguous. That means any claims that have been filed thereafter are entitled to a six-year look-back period and all the remedies. And that includes attorney fees and costs and liquidated damages up to 200% of what's owed to the plaintiff. When the court determines whether or not the appellate division was correct in stating that the plaintiffs can be entitled to all of these remedies, you have to also consider the fact of the strong public policy in New Jersey. It's very important to keep that in your mind because it was created because there is an imbalance of power between an employer and an employee. And the only power that an employee gets is the power that they receive from the New Jersey employment laws, which would include the wage and hour laws. Without that, the employer has all the power. And it's important to remember that the Wage Theft Act was created specifically so that to protect employees from unfair wages and excessive hours. It's not to correct or protect the employer's pocketbook. That is not the purpose of these laws. In 2019, the legislature specifically stated that it will take effect immediately as of August 6, 2019. And because of that, the plaintiffs filed their lawsuit 2.5 years later. Not only did they file their lawsuit 2.5 years later, but they also continued to work for defendant IEW after the enactment of the Wage Theft Act. And because of that, they're entitled to all of the remedies. The legislature is smart. They know what they're doing. They said that it shall take effect immediately on purpose. If they wanted to say what the defendant is wanting this court to determine, that it should only apply to conduct occurring after August 6, 2019, they could have said that. And they have said that in other situations. And I'll just give a few examples. For the foreclosure statute, the statute of limitations changed in 2019 from 20 years to 6 years. And that statute specifically stated that this act shall take effect immediately and apply to residential mortgages executed on or after the effective date. That's the same year that the Wage Theft Act was enacted. And yet the legislature said to things that occurred, contracts that were entered into after the effective date.
Can you give us the statutory site?
Sure. NJSA 2A:50-56.1C.
I'm sorry.
Did I say that too fast?
Yes.
NJSA 2A:50-56.1C.
You said that reduced the statute of limitations from 20 to 6 years?
That's correct. And the legislature specifically stated there, and I'll quote it one more time, this act shall take effect immediately and apply to residential mortgages executed on or after the effective date. And so going back to the legislative intent, it's clear that if the legislature intended...
So let's accept that those mortgages were, there was a 20-year statute of limitations reduced to six. So it's not as if a right didn't exist and now it did. It was a right that did exist and now doesn't. It's the exact opposite of what we have here.
Understood. And I'm not trying to say that the Wage Theft Act is analogous to a foreclosure action. What I'm saying is...
I'm wondering if that example is not proving the opposite point from the one you want to make.
I respectfully disagree. And the reason why is because if the legislature intended it for the statute to occur only to conduct that occurred after the enactment date, after the effective date, they would have put that in the actual statute. And they didn't do that in the Wage Theft Act. They specifically said that it was effective immediately.
And effective immediately has been held by this court many times to be prospective only from the effective date onward.
I agree with you. And again, I'm only asking for prospective application.
Are there any cases in the example that you just gave us where someone in 2020 or 2021 came forward with a foreclosure action that was 7 years beyond the date of accrual?
Just so I understand your question, are you saying that it was entered, the mortgage was entered into after the revisions?
No.
No, before.
Yes. Someone thought they had 20 years and all of a sudden it was narrowed to six.
Yes.
Are there cases where someone came forward after six and said, this isn't fair and I challenge the statute? And has there been any such ruling?
I believe there was a case, and I apologize, I can't remember the name of the case at the moment, that I did see that the court determined since the mortgage, in that case, the mortgage was entered into prior to the amendments. And so the court said because of the specific language in the statute, then the 6 years, because the defendant was trying to file a motion to dismiss.
Because of the language in the statute, then what?
The language in the statute specifically says that...
No, I understand what the language says, but what did the court say? Because of the language in the statute, then what?
Says that it's only effective as to any mortgages that occurred after the effective date.
So they still had the 20 years?
Correct. Anyone prior to that.
Had the old statute of limitations.
I'm sorry?
They had the old statute of limitations.
Correct.
Point being that the old rules applied.
Right. For that situation.
How does that help you here?
Again, I'm not saying that it's a foreclosure situation. This is the Wage Theft Act. It's very different. There, again, is legislative intent, strong public policy to protect employees.
But I think that the example you gave, and it was news to me, that the foreclosure statute was interpreted in that way, actually makes the opposite point, which is that the mortgage, the presumably the default and things happened before the amendment are governed by the statute of limitations that everybody thought they were under when that prior conduct occurred.
Isn't that only because the legislature specifically said that it applies only to residential mortgages executed on or after the effective date? So your point is, if the legislature wants the old rules to apply and a new statute of limitations to only take effect, for example, 6 years from now, it would say this applies only to wage theft that occurs on or after the effective date of this statute of August 6, 2019. And they didn't say that here. And so you're arguing that because they don't have that specific language, that means that the law in effect at the time the claim is brought is what law applies.
That's correct. Yes.
But can't the same argument be made with regard to if the legislature wanted to ensure that it was retroactive, then the legislature would have put specific language in this statute, similar to what they did in Hildreth, to make it clear that the amendments would apply to actions that occurred prior to the effective date, as the legislature did in Hildreth, stating applying to child sex abuse that occurred prior to, on, or after December 1st, 2019. So, I mean, the same argument can be made, particularly given the fact that it's usually the case that when a statute states that it will take effect immediately, this court has construed that language to mean prospective application only.
I agree with you. I'm only asking for prospective application. Pursuant to the plain language of the statute, the Wage Theft Act says that you get 6 years prior to the commencement of the action. The plaintiffs filed their lawsuit on April 13th, 2022. Therefore, right.
So what I'm saying is, with regard to your argument that if the legislature wanted the amendments only to apply beginning on August 6, 2019 and forward, that they could have put in language making that clear. So comparing this statute to Hildreth, what is your argument with regard to the fact that the language in Hildreth is pretty different from the language we have here?
I respectfully disagree with you, and the reason is the issue in Hildreth had to do with the Tort Claims Act, which had no retroactive language in there. And a review of the decision of this court stated that applying the statute or applying the law as of the date, and as it read, as of the date the plaintiff filed the lawsuit, is not applying it retroactively, it's applying it prospectively.
But it was based on the underlying amendment in Hildreth that was retroactive. I mean, it's clearly retroactive, right?
The CSAA was retroactive, but the Tort Claims Act was not, and it didn't say that. And in the decision, this court determined that that didn't matter. And this court did not engage in a retroactive analysis on the Tort Claims Act because they said that the plaintiff filed their lawsuit, WS filed their lawsuit, after the amendments to the Tort Claims Act occurred.
Because there was no question that claim could be filed at that time, correct? There was no question that the claim in Hildreth could be filed at that time because the statute made clear, the amendments made clear, that it applied to claims filed on, before, or after December 1st, 2019. What we did in Hildreth was trying to reconcile two different statutes, right? That's why the focus was on the Tort Claims Act, ensuring in order to give effect to the expanded availability of filing of those sex abuse claims, we had to reconcile what was done in the Tort Claims Act amendments. So what I'm saying, don't you agree that that case is not exactly what we have here? And the appellate division relied heavily on Hildreth, but these cases are not identical in terms of what's taking place and what the question is that we're grappling with.
I agree that they're not identical. Most cases are not identical, but the analysis that was provided by this court is extremely helpful in this case, and it should be applied the same way because the plaintiffs filed their lawsuit 2.5 years after the Wage Theft Act was enacted. The Wage Theft Act does not say that it will take effect on August 6, 2025. That's what the defendant wants this court to say, but that's not what the legislature said. And because of that, plaintiffs should be entitled to all remedies under the law.
Presumably, this is not the first time a statute of limitations has been changed. Is there any case either from New Jersey or from any other state where a statute of limitations is changed while the statute of limitations on a claim was still pending? And then the question is, what happens? Is it 2 years or is it 6 years? Is that applying prospectively or retroactively? What do other cases tell us about this question?
You were correct before in saying that the Diane B. Allen Equal Pay Act did change the statute of limitations to 6 years. And I am aware of one specific case in Passaic County. It was a trial court decision, Norcia, where the court applied those changes, the amendments, prospectively, and that plaintiff was entitled to a 6-year look-back period.
And what was the language of that statute?
Expanding shall take effect immediately.
And it also created a right to treble damages where that had not previously occurred, correct?
That's correct.
Sorry, so you're saying in the Diane B. Allen Equal Pay Act, you're aware of, first of all, you're aware of that as the only other example, and then you're aware of only one case where the 6-year look-back was held to go into effect immediately and not 6 years from whatever date the
Diane B. Allen Act went into effect.
That's correct.
April 7th, 2019, your client starts working for the defendant company. What advice would you give an employer on that day as to what penalties might apply if the employer does not abide by the law?
Well, truthfully, it goes against my nature to give employers advice.
And yet we need to examine the case from both sides, because whatever the rules are,
I'm just making a joke.
Employers are entitled to the protection of the law.
No, I understand. In April of 2019, you said? I would say that it's unlawful to fail to pay employees for pre-shift and post-shift work.
And what penalties apply for a
violation
of that?
Penalties apply that they would be, well, it depends. The wage and hour law, you had attorney fees and costs, not the wage payment law. And also any damages that are owed to that individual.
But not the 200% liquidated damages.
Yes, but, you know, there's one thing that I'm glad you brought that up. There's another part of the Wage Theft Act that's important here. What I refer to as a safe harbor provision, because for the first offense of the employer, if they remedy the situation, admit their wrongdoing of failing to pay overtime wages, for instance, and they pay within 30 days, they don't have to pay liquidated damages. So employers are able to remedy any situations that might have occurred without having to pay up to 200%.
But one would not advise, reasonably, not advise an employer in April of 2019 that they could face liquidated damages of 200%, correct?
Well, that's correct. Well, I don't know. It depends. I mean, this legislative bill was pending since January. So it depends on if the attorney is actually following it, but no, as the law stated, no, I would not say that you could have a penalty up to 200%.
Nor would the advice, potentially reasonable advice, be that you face retaliation claims in April of 2019. Is that correct?
I don't agree with that, and I'll explain why. So a couple of reasons. The way that the statute read previously, it states that the employer cannot discharge or take a discriminatory action against an employee. Even though it didn't use the word retaliation, that is essentially a retaliation claim, cannot discharge or take a discriminatory action against the employee. Another thing is, under the Fair Labor Standards Act, it is unlawful to retaliate against an employee for complaining about unfair or illegal pay practices. So the employer was aware that that is a potential retaliation claim. And also, under the Conscientious Employee Protection Act, the whistleblower law in this state, it's unlawful for an employer to retaliate against an employee because they objected to or refused to do something that they believed was unlawful, and that includes a violation of a statute.
Let me answer it this way instead. Would it be appropriate to advise a client, these are the penalties you face under the law today, but who knows, 6 months, 2 years from now, the legislature may change it. I can't tell you what those penalties might be, but you might be subjected to them. Would that be appropriate advice? And is that, in effect, what we're talking about here?
I think that if I was speaking to an employer back in April of 2019, I would go over all the laws that they're potentially violating and the damages that they may have to pay the employee. And, you know, honestly, candidly, attorneys always say, well, it kind of depends, right? I don't know what the future holds. I don't know what you're going to be subject to in the future. So I think that that is a possibility. So but even under SEPA, I'm sorry.
We're talking about this statute here, not other statutes. Is it appropriate to conceive of a scheme where the legislature can create new remedies or new claims and give them retroactive effect?
But the way that I am applying the Wage Theft Act amendments is not retroactively. This is not a situation where I filed a lawsuit prior to August 6, 2019, and now I'm trying to take the benefits of the amendments. Go ahead.
You're using the date the complaint is filed as the triggering event.
That's correct.
Not the date the wages were or were not paid.
That's correct, because pursuant to the statute, it says the commencement of the action. And commencement of the action is filing a claim in court.
Can I ask a question? I'm sorry, about the WPL instead of the WHL. I thought in the appellate division decision, it just said,
and, you know, the WPL similarly. What is your, do you have a separate WPL claim? What is the argument that a 6-year statute of limitation somehow also applies to the WPL, even though there was no amendment to the WPL to that effect? What is the status of the WPL claim and what law applies to it?
So we do have two claims, one under the wage and hour law for failure to pay overtime wages. The second claim is under the wage payment law, which is because the employer failed to pay all money owed within the 30 days. So they're required to pay twice per month, all money owed, and the employer failed to do that because they didn't pay the overtime wages. So we do have those
same two money that wasn't paid under the WHL, right?
That's correct.
And Aptiv did say that you couldn't recover the same thing under both statutes, correct?
That's correct.
So you don't have a WPL claim that's independent of the WHL claim that's for some other failure, correct?
That's correct. We have both of those claims for the same facts.
You just mentioned something a moment ago about the cause of action language in the statute. What are you referring to?
I can point you to it exactly. Just give me 1 second. It says when it was commenced, rather than the commencement of the action. Is that what you're referring to?
I just wanted to understand your comment from a moment ago when you said something that the operative language was, you said something about that, and I didn't understand your point.
Oh, my point was that the plaintiffs filed their lawsuit.
I understand you're saying the statute applies. The operative date is the commencement, is the date the lawsuit was filed. But what's the statutory language you're relying on in saying that?
The statutory language is when it says that it has to be no action shall commence. I'm sorry, I don't think I have it in front of me.
Are you looking at the second sentence of 25.1, perhaps?
Perhaps, but I think I left it over there, so I'm sorry about that. Yes, so it says that no claim for unpaid minimum wages, unpaid overtime compensation, unlawful discharge, or other discriminatory acts taken in retaliation against the employer, other damages under this act shall be valid with respect to any such claim which has arisen more than 6 years prior to the commencement of the action. And that is...
Then the second sentence, keep reading the second sentence. I think that was what your point was in determining when the action is commenced.
Right, correct. And then it says basically the action shall be considered commenced and then skipping ahead when it's filed within a court of, you know, appropriate jurisdiction.
And that differs from other statutes of limitations in any substantive way?
I think it does. For instance, under the law against discrimination, it's 2 years from the last adverse employment action. So if the employee was terminated, then as of the date of termination, that's when the 2 years starts to run. But in this specific situation, it's the date in which the plaintiff filed their lawsuit, and then you get 6 years prior to that of any damages that they're entitled to.
Have a look at your notes. Is there anything else you'd like to
add? I'm trying to see. I just want to briefly discuss the statute of repose. It's not our position that the Wage Theft Act created a statute of repose, or the wage and hour law and the wage payment law has a statute of repose. And I just want to point the court quickly to the statement, the sponsor statement that specifically refers to it as a statute of limitations. It's the March 18, 2019 Assembly Appropriations Committee statement. And on the third page, it says, this is the committee amendments. And it says, have the bill's extension of the statute of limitations to 6 years apply to unlawful discharge or other retaliation claims. So they call it themselves a statute of limitations, the legislature.
What do you believe it is?
I think it's a statute of limitations. I do. I don't think it's a statute of repose. If it was, then again, it will go against the fundamental purpose of the New Jersey wage and hour law, New Jersey wage payment law. Why would claims cease to exist for unpaid overtime and minimum wage violations.
And you mentioned a number of times the legislative purpose, and the legislature fulfills its goals in many different ways. And the fact that there is an important policy behind a statute, which clearly there is, does not mean it's retroactive or does not mean it applies to a particular set of clients. I mean, I heard all you said about the importance of the policy, but we're not here to in any way evaluate the policy. We're here to figure out whether it applies to this particular claim. Do you understand the distinction? The fact that something has an important policy behind it doesn't mean it applies to every claim that might be brought under it, depending on the timing of that claim.
I understand what you're saying, but I'm not asking for retroactive application. That analysis is not applicable here.
If you're not asking for retroactive application, was the appellate division right to rely on Hildreth, which clearly, in which the sexual assault statute was very expressly retroactive?
I think that the appellate division was correct to rely on Hildreth, not because the CSAA was retroactive, but because the Tort Claims Act was not. And this court determined that applying the law as it read the date the plaintiff filed the lawsuit is not applying it retroactively, it's applying it prospectively.
Your adversaries across the aisle, I think, noted that in some of your papers, you referred to whatever it is as a statute of repose. Is that correct?
That is correct. And we were relying on the appellate division case. But after further review, we do not believe it is a statute of repose. And after reviewing the documents, I believe it's a statute of limitations.
So the appellate division was wrong in calling it that?
They said that it acted like a statute of repose. The appellate division not specifically say it was a statute of repose, but no, I believe it's a statute of limitations.
Which documents? You said you reviewed documents. You mentioned the assembly statement of March 18th. Anything else?
You mean as for the statute of repose?
Yes.
I just did a lot of research and prepared for today, honestly. That's pretty much it. And
no, I appreciate
and
that.
All the statute of repose specifically goes to construction cases.
We're looking for authority. Is there any other specific authority beyond the assembly statement you can point us to?
I think just the language itself in the statute shows that it's not a statute of repose, because it's commencement of the litigation, it doesn't start running from the last act of a specific thing, like in the construction when the job is done, for instance.
Was the sponsor's statement to the Senate not speak to the issue, not the assembly statement, but the sponsor's statement in the Senate?
Well, the sponsor's statement specifically sets forth the purpose of strengthening the remedies and penalties for the New Jersey wage and hour law, New Jersey wage payment law. It just, again, states how important it is to protect employees in New Jersey. Your honors don't have any other questions. That's it. I just respectfully request the court to affirm the appellate division's decision.
Thank you, Ms. Blanchfield. Mr. Berg.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm here today on behalf of NELA New Jersey, an organization which represents employees throughout the state of New Jersey. And I have to begin by commending my adversaries in this case by taking what I think is a very straightforward analysis and cloaking it in the most essentially overburdened analysis that this court has to perform.
That's quite a compliment.
They're very good lawyers. And throughout the course of this argument, I've heard many statements made which are kind of troubling. Plaintiffs, employees, and plaintiffs' lawyers are seeking to stretch statutes. They're seeking to take advantage of the law that the legislature has passed. All we do as plaintiffs' lawyers is take the law that the legislature gives us and apply it to the facts of the cases and try and get a remedy for our client.
Mr. Burton, I don't think there was name calling on either side. We have a straightforward issue to try to figure out.
I understand. I'm not name calling at all, Judge. Not at all.
But I don't think I didn't hear a lot of pejoratives.
Maybe it's my years on the plaintiff's side that I take it that way. This statute was amended on August 6, 2019, fairly clearly expanded the remedies. It did not make illegal things that were already illegal. As Justice Wayner Apter pointed out, these things have been illegal since the 60s. And yet, all they did was give some additional remedies, some liquidated damages, some attorney's fees, and that's it. That's all the statute did. And in this case, these plaintiffs worked for the company both before and then after, and then were underpaid during the period of time that this new statute was in effect. So the appellate division correctly said, you get the 6-year look back because you suffered a pay violation during the period of time that the new statute is in effect. How else can you apply this statute but to apply it in that manner? To do so otherwise would say, as Justice Wayner Apter pointed out, this statute doesn't come into force in effect until 2025. And nowhere in the record is there any language suggesting that that's the case.
Is that really the case? The law went into effect on
August 6th of 2019.
And had you brought a claim on December 6th of 2019, you would have been entitled to the enhanced penalties for those additional months.
Correct.
So it did go into effect. You might not have been able to reap the full benefit of it for 6 years, but it went into effect on day one.
Oh, Chief Justice, I disagree with you on that. I think you would get the 6-year look back. And there was a question about the other.
I understand that, but you were suggesting that the law didn't come to fruition for a full 6 years.
I'm suggesting that's what the defense position is, that you don't get the full 6-year look back until 2025.
Is it their position that in December of 2019, you could not get for 5 months since the law was enacted 200% liquidated damages, the enhanced penalty?
No, I don't. It's funny. I heard Mr. Riccobono concede today that you do get all that.
Indeed.
He actually conceded that in his brief.
Right. What I'm saying is, let's say, for example, I filed a complaint on August 7th of 2019. I think my client, and I think the proper application of the law, is that my client would get a 6-year look back from August 7, 2019 to August 7, 2013.
Understood. But I think what the position on the other side of the aisle is being characterized as is this just postpones for 6 years the import of this important statute when it wouldn't. If you had filed shortly months after the effective date, you would have a claim under it.
But the argument today has been that we can't reach back beyond August 6th of 2019.
Understood. I think we all understand the respective positions here,
right.
but it was late in the day.
Can I ask you one question? And this may sound ridiculous, but if you filed a complaint one day before the new statute, you would get a 2-year look back.
That's correct.
Even though the violation had been going on for 6 years.
That's correct.
If you filed it the day after the statute, you get the full 6-year look back.
That's correct.
Why is that not retroactive for the 4 years that have lapsed?
Because the remedies were enhanced. Because I'll give you an example of what I believe a retroactive application would be.
It had no remedy before.
Well, you had your...
You weren't enhanced. Right. You had the 2 years. I'm just pursuing that question. I'm sorry.
No.
Interrupt.
Go ahead.
If you filed 2 days before the statute, you had no penalty for the 4 years, for the full six, for four of the 6 years. You had a remedy only for 2 of the 6 years.
That's correct.
But if so, it's not an enhanced remedy. There was no remedy.
Well, no, there was always a remedy. You got your unpaid wages.
But not for the four years.
Absolutely. We're in complete agreement. Let me address it this way. So there was a question about other statutes where the statute of limitation had been amended. And the answer is yes. That was Norcia versus New Jersey City University. Norcia was my case. I argued that case in the trial level. In that case, I asserted a LAD claim, straightforward LAD claim. an Equal Pay Act claim and a Diane B. Allen Equal Pay Act claim.
Can you give a citation?
Sure. It's actually in your appendix. It's PAS-L 1972-19.
Well, I'm sorry.
PAS-L 1972-19.
No, that's the docket number, but that's the citation number to the decision.
It's a trial.
Is it a published case?
Unpublished? No, it's an unpublished decision.
And what did it hold?
So in that case, Judge Mongiardo conducted the analysis, and in that case, the Diane B. Allen Equal Pay Act had come into effect in 2018. I filed that case a year later. Same argument I'm making here today I made there, which was, since there was a pay violation after the enactment of the enhanced remedy, I get the six-year look back. Judge Mongiardo said, you get a two-year look back under the LAD for pay. You get a six-year look back under the Diane B. Allen case. So I was able to reach back from 2019 to 2013.
Are there any published cases on it?
Not that I'm aware of. That is, as far as I know, Judge Justice, the only published case, or the only case that is currently interpreting the LAD. There are unpublished cases in the federal court, but none that a state court case that is interpreted.
Do they all come out the same way, the unpublished federal cases?
The unpublished federal case is factually different because in that case, the plaintiff had filed.
What is that case?
Justice Patterson.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I'm drawing a blank.
Really
is it another Diane Allen?
It's a Diane B. Allen case, but in that case, the plaintiff was not employed by the employer at the time that the Diane B. Allen Act went into effect and therefore was not afforded the protections of the statute. So they said you can't get the protection of the statute when you weren't actually employed at the time. Here, I think it's the same analysis. If you're employed by an employer after August 6th of 2019 and you suffer a pay violation, then the Wage Theft Act applies.
I'm sorry, I don't understand what happened in that case. Yeah.
Why would that matter? Why does that matter?
What, that you were employed and suffered a pay violation after?
In for purposes of your argument that you should be able to reach back 6 years.
Because I think if an employer commits a violation of the Wage Theft Act after the act is in effect, then you get the remedies that are afforded by the act.
And I'm sorry, I'm three or four steps behind you. What was the ruling of the federal court?
Oh, Justice Patterson, it was that because the plaintiff in that case was not employed by the employer when the Diane B. Allen Act came into effect, that plaintiff was not afforded the protections of the Diane B. Allen Act. In other words, she ceased to be an employee before the Diane B. Allen Act came into effect. So when she filed suit a year later and tried to say, I'm covered by the Diane B. Allen case, the court said, no, you're not covered by it because you were not employed. You didn't suffer a violation of the act while you were employed by the employer.
Let's move beyond the unpublished cases.
Okay. I just think it's a very simple analysis here. I don't think that you need to wrestle with retroactivity. Nobody has asked, at least on our side, for retroactive application. We're asking for prospective application. To Justice Wayne Apter's words, applying the law in effect at the time the complaint is filed, even when that law changed, the requirements for filing a complaint is not applying the statute retroactively. It's applying a statute prospectively. That's what happened here. These plaintiffs filed their case 2 years after the act was in effect. I don't understand how it's even possible that this court can conclude that they don't get the benefit of the enhanced remedies under the Wage Theft Act.
If that is so, why did the legislature in the child sexual abuse case bother to put in the very specific retroactivity language about conduct and how it applied to conduct that had already happened before the change in the law, and specifically went out on, did something very different from what it normally does in order to state that we intend in this situation to include conduct that has already occurred before we made this change? What is that about? Is that just extra language? If what you're saying is that statutes of limitations, which you're indicating you this is. If they're changed, it's the date of the filing that governs. They didn't need to say that if that's the, if that's so.
They didn't, but I agree with my co-counsel. I don't believe that the analysis in Hildreth triggered on the CSAA. It triggered on the Tort Claims Act.
It was directly dealing with the Tort Claims Act, but right. it all arose from that language that's in the child sexual abuse statute, which is really a quite unusual language. I don't think it really, I've ever seen anything quite like that. And obviously it reflects the legislature's views as to the importance of the later in life claims of people who were abused as children. If what you are saying about the date, the operative date being the date of the filing, applies even in to prospective statutes, that was a waste of paper, that language that they put in there.
I think they're two very, Justice Patterson, I think they're two very different things. I think what we have here, and again, I'm not arguing for retroactive application. When the law changed, when the Wage Theft Act came into effect, there were enhanced remedies that an employee could recover. I'm not saying go back in time, take an employee from 2014, 2015, and file a complaint now trying to shoehorn into the Wage Theft Act. That is an example where I would say I'm trying to retroactively apply this statute. But for a New Jersey employee who is not paid overtime in, say, 2022, and was employed back to 2013 or 2014 and files a claim under the Wage Theft Act, I think you have to apply the statute in effect at 2022 and allow them to recover the benefits of the statute. To say that it's effective immediately means looking forward from August 6th of 2019. That's okay, all I'm arguing
obviously
for.
The dispute here is what happens? Effective, right. What is effective immediately? Is it the date of the conduct, or is it the date of the filing?
Well, Justice Patterson, the conduct is not paying them the overtime. Right. The date of the filing.
So all I'm doing is stating what the dispute here is between the two parties. I'm that's really the issue here.
Right.
So you're taking a position with respect to the date of the filing is operative. Your adversary has a different view.
I understand. But what I'm saying is I don't understand how applying the law in effect the time that an action is commenced, we don't get a six-year look back if the violation has occurred after the new statute's in effect. That's my argument. I think you absolutely do.
If the violation occurred after the new statute, I don't think that's their position. Their position is violations that occurred before the new statute. As I understand their position, it's not about what happened, violations that occurred after the statute was amended. It's what happened with respect to conduct before it. I think if that's your position, yours and theirs are the same, because I think everybody is conceding here or stating that the conduct that followed the effective date is subject to the amendment.
But the difference is, Justice Patterson, they're saying you don't get the benefit of the six-year look back. They're saying that the cutoff is 2 years from 2019.
And you said it's not retroactive because you're not asking for relief for an employee who was working back in 2014, 15, or 16. But under your recitation of how this would work, would you not be able, if you had an employee working in 2017, but no longer working for the employer who was in violation, you filed the complaint in 2020, let's say 2018, 19 he was working. And certainly within, he left the employee before the new act came into effect, but filed the complaint after the new act came into effect. He would recover under the new act.
Justice Ellen, I totally disagree with you. Let me try and clear that up.
Please, because I think that's what in effect would happen based upon what you said.
No. And let me be very clear. My position is, if there is an employee who is working for a company in New Jersey, and that employee is working for that company after August 6th of 2019, And for any period of time after August 6th of 2019, that employee is not paid overtime and files a complaint, that employee gets all the benefits of the Wage Theft Act.
All the way back for 6 years?
If he or she was employed there for that period of time, yes.
How does it say that's the triggering event? It says the triggering event is, that, according to what you said, the filing of the complaint.
But you still, Justice Solomon, you still have to have the underlying violation.
The underlying violation is that when he was working for that employer, he was not receiving lawful wages. He was not receiving them.
But,
and he filed within, he filed within whatever the limitations period is, after the effective date of the statute. Why does he not then, just as the employee you were discussing, get the benefit of the statute?
Because
that would be retroactive application. I agree.
That's not
what you're asking for. But
right.
how would you distinguish that? Why is that not the same as the situation you're saying? The law was violated. The complaint was filed after the effective date of the statute. There's nothing in the law that you've recited that makes that any different than what the example I gave.
Justice Solomon, I think...
I may just not understand it, but...
Okay, let me try it this way. I agree with the defendants to the extent that pre-August 6, 2019, there was a two-year look-back period of time, and there was, you got the lost wages, you didn't get the enhanced remedies. Once the law changed on August 6th...
I need you to start that sentence with something. What happens pre-2019?
An employee is not paid overtime. There is an overtime violation.
There's an overtime violation pre-August 6, 2019.
Right.
And that is under a two-year look back.
Correct, Justice Patterson. And then when the law changed on August 6th of 2019, there is now a six-year look back, and there are the enhanced remedies. So if, for example, in September of 2019, an employee was underpaid, was not paid overtime, that employee timely filed suit, that employee would get the remedies under the new statute.
For the conduct that occurred after the amendment.
Correct. No, and I, reaching I back 6 years.
Before. 6 years.
You're saying before. As
well. I'm saying you get everything.
He gets
it all.
Only if they're still working for the employer at the time. So if someone left their employer on August 5th, 2019, but on August 8th, 2019, commences an action for recovery of unpaid wages that occurred prior to then, you're saying they don't get the look back because they're no longer working for the employer?
Right, because they weren't employed at the time that the violation, that the statute provided the enhanced remedy.
Say that? I don't understand that to be Ms. Blanchfield's argument. Because there was a lot of argument about the commencement of the action.
Right.
I'm not sure where it says you must also be working.
Right. In the section in the statute that we're looking at, it doesn't say this only applies to employees. So are you referring to a different statutory section that says you must be employed in order to bring a WHL claim to begin with?
No, but I think it's common sense to say that you can't get the enhanced look back if the violation didn't occur during the period of time when the enhanced look back was actionable.
But you certainly can bring an action under the WHL-WPL after you've left the employee.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm not foreclosing that.
The triggering event is not the filing of the complaint. It triggers your rights under the amended statute. The triggering event, you're saying, is when you were employed or left the employee, although that's not always the triggering event either.
No, I'm saying the violation of the statute is not to pay the wages, the overtime wages, right? All I'm saying is that an employee, in my view, in order to have the benefit of the enhanced remedies,
still be working for the employee,
must have suffered that violation when the statute was in effect.
Where does it say that? Because if we propose the rule that you're asking for, it would simply say that there's a six-year look back for those based on what the statute says and what has been argued, there is a 6-year look back for actions commenced after the effective date of the statute, because that was the triggering event. How would that not apply to somebody who is no longer employed? It doesn't say anything in the statute about this. And clearly, wage payment law violations and wage and hour law violations can be commenced at any time within the applicable statute of limitations.
Because then I think you are giving retroactive application to the statute.
Why?
Because you're reaching back in time to apply it to events that had happened before it was in effect.
Same logic applies to the case, to the argument that's being made by your adversaries. This is reaching back to events that occurred before the effective date of the statute. I think you're helping making their point. And we don't have right. This case, so that distinction's not in this case. But I think what you're saying is a strong point, but it would also apply to a situation where the conduct took place before the amendment.
But I liken this to, say, an LAD type action where there is a continuing violation. That is that the failure to pay the overtime continues. If that was a pattern over that period of time after the statute was amended,
then a continuing violation extends the statute of limitations.
Correct. I think
I don't think we're really talking about whether the statute of limitations goes indefinitely into the future here. I think we're talking more about 4 months of conduct that took place before the amendment. That's all we're talking about. It's a very narrow question.
Right. But I think under these facts, they get those 4 months. And I think an employee that filed similar to these facts would get however far back it goes into the 6-year period.
That may be a good point to break. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cabona, brief rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Just a few brief points. We've spent a lot of time today talking about whether the Chapter 212 amendments contain a statute of repose or a statute of limitations. And I'd like to respectfully reorient the court to what I think is really the critical inquiry here. When applying the Chapter 212 amendments, and what the appellate division did here, was it applying it to events that occurred before its enactment? And did it change the legal consequences of those acts? That's what the court has held retroactive application looks like in its prior guidance. So whether or not we construe this as a statute of repose or a statute of limitations, the result, the conclusion here is still the same. We are still applying the law to events that occurred before its enactment and changing the legal consequences of those acts. Second point I want-
The legislature did that. In Hildreth,
correct.
In the statute in Hildreth, the legislature can do that.
Absolutely, and we're not disputing that they can't, correct. They did not do that here for all the reasons we've mentioned already. The second point I wanted to make was just to briefly address the leading point from my adversary about how the wage payment law and the wage and hour law are public policy driven and remedial statutes and humanitarian statutes. Even accepting that is so, and we can assume for purposes of this hypothetical, the legislature is aware of that as well. If they wanted to effectuate that consideration in passing the Chapter 212 amendments, they would have used the language that was at issue in Hildreth. They would have said this will apply to conduct that occurred prior to, on, or after. If the remedial reach and the humanitarian purpose behind those laws was so broad as to effectuate a retroactive application or to warrant retroactive application, the legislature clearly could have done that and specifically said so, like they did with the amendment to the CSAA.
Counsel, if somebody goes has been talking to a lawyer about their 2 or so years worth of underpayment of overtime and wages, and they decide to file suit in September of 2019, and the amendment goes through, but they file anyway, what are the damages governed by? What's the limits?
I think then you'd have a situation where you're actually parsing out the claims and the available damages that might be available to each, because you'd still be within the 2-year statute of limitations that would have arisen prior to the August 6, 2019 effective date.
Even if you file after the statute's been...
September, let's say September 1st, 2019. Mm-hmm. I think that's correct.
So the two-year statute of limitations would still apply?
For claims that accrued prior to August 6, 2019.
And when did those accrue?
At the time the employer failed to pay the wages that were due or failed to pay the overtime wages.
So so for a claim of that's on July 15th, failure to pay.
Of 2019?
It's not of 2019. It's not barred by the statute of limitations. Do the new remedies apply to that?
I would submit they do not. I think the line of distinction we have to draw here is that August 6, 2019 date. And that's what this whole retroactive analysis comes down to, right? Is are we applying a new law to events that occurred prior to its effective date?
And I'm sorry, let me just follow up with something. What tells us that the two-year statute of limitations still survives and would apply in that example I gave you? For a suit that begins, let's say it begins in October or even December of 2019, what would allow that two-year statute of limitations to survive?
I suppose you would look at what is the plaintiff alleging the time period is in which they were their employer failed to pay them the wages.
But what statute would the plaintiff look at to determine how to prepare their cause of action? Wouldn't they look at this statute that's in effect as of August of 2019?
For the claims that arose after August 6, 2019, yes.
Over the last 2 years?
I think that's, going back, I think we have to actually parse out those claims. If there's claims that predate August 6, 2019, those are subject to the statute of limitations and the remedies that were in effect as of the date prior to August 6, 2019. For the claims that arose after August 6, 2019, those can take advantage of, and I'm not saying that in the pejorative sense, of the Chapter 212 amendments. So I think it really does depend. And we have that situation here where there's some claims that arose or accrued before August 6, 2019, and some claims that purport to have arisen after August 6, 2019. Getting back to the humanitarian reach and the remedial purpose.
Go ahead. You can finish the thing.
Humanitarian reach and the remedial purpose of the statute. We cite in our brief the original version of the wage and hour law included language occurred prior to, on, or after. As we argued in our brief, that shows that when the legislature intends for the wage and hour law to have retroactive effect, it uses that language which suggests that.
You're talking about, I'm sorry, the original version of the 2019 amendment?
No, I'm sorry, the original version of the wage and hour law in 1966. It was on page, we cited to this on page 20 of our brief, Your Honor.
In other words, you're saying that the original version tied it into the date of the conduct?
Statute of limitations versus statute of repose. Counsel referred to the assembly statement, which we're told spoke to it as a statute of limitations. Can you address that?
And I think my response to that, Your Honor, is whether we call it a statute of limitations or whether we call it a statute of repose ultimately does not affect the retroactive analysis because the result is the same. You are applying a law to conduct that occurred prior to the effective date of that law. That's what retroactive analysis looks at. Whether I think we call this a statute of limitations or a statute of repose, I ultimately think that's a red herring. It's arguably worse when it's a statute of repose because of the way a statute of repose operates, which is to declare invalid claims after a certain period of time has passed. So I think it's arguably worse with a statute of repose, but ultimately the result here is the same.
We want to get it right, of course.
Yes.
Does the assembly statement address the issue as far as you're concerned?
I don't think the assembly statement impacts it one way or the other.
Why not?
Again, I come back to, if we call it a statute of limitations, we are still looking at, are we applying a law to conduct that occurred before the effective date of that law? If that answers Your Honor's question.
I'm asking a different question. Craft the beginning of this opinion and describe the statute. Is it a statute of limitations or a statute of repose? Before we get to the ultimate question that the parties are, of course, concerned about. Does the assembly statement clarify language that is arguably
a bit ambiguous.
And maybe there's a third iteration of a limitations period that we're learning about here today that we're not all previously aware of, maybe. Our position is, I think the appellate division got it right in defining it as a statute of repose, because we're looking at the commencement of the action and then going back a period of time to measure what claims are valid within that period of time.
They used a slightly different language. They didn't define it that way. They said it's been treated that way, or words to that effect.
You're right, Your Honor. Correct. The final point I wanted to make here, we talked a little bit about the Diane B. Allen Act. There was a case referenced from the division, the District of New Jersey. It is unpublished. It's Parado versus Morgan Advanced Materials, 2019, Westlaw 192903, DNJ, I believe it's 2019 or so.
Published or unpublished?
It is an unpublished decision, as I recall, Your Honor. It refused to apply retroactively to conduct predating the EPA's effective date. In that case, the legislature passed the EPA on April 25th, 2018. It postponed the effective date until July 1st, 2018. The court in that case held that the delayed enactment shows the legislature intended for the EPA to have prospective application.
Let's go beyond unpublished cases.
Understood. I'll end where I began here today, Your Honor, which was asking the court the question, if what the appellate division did here was not retroactive application, then what is retroactive application? And I keep coming back to this. Is it applying events occurred before its effective date and changing the legal consequences? I think both parties agree the appellate division's decision does exactly that. So for those reasons, we ask the court to reverse the appellate division's decision and hold that the Chapter 212 amendments do not apply retroactively. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. We will take the matter under advisement.